I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Okay, thanks for sending over this stack of sources. Today on the Deep Dive, we're tackling a really fundamental topic. The potential environmental hazards tied to pesticides.
It really is, and it's such a massive balancing act, isn't it? You've got growers needing to manage pests, for instance, but also this huge need to protect, well, everyone else, the public, workers, and the environment itself.
Exactly.
And these sources really lay out just how complex that balance gets.
That's our mission here, then. Take this material you've shared and really dig into that core challenge. Pesticides have a target, right? But how do we make sure they only hit that target?
And don't cause problems elsewhere.
Precisely. So we'll unpack how they move, what the risks are when they, you know, escape, and the main ways those risks are managed, according to this info.
And there are some, I think, really crucial insights in here about why they behave the way they do. It's not just about the initial spray.
Right. It's that whole journey after application. Okay, let's unpack this.
So first off, there's a regulatory framework trying to manage this balance. As the sources point out, it's a system. You've got agencies like California's DPR, the Department of Pesticide Regulation,
okay,
and county agricultural commissioners, and they work with the federal US EPA. And California, actually, they've been regulating pesticides since, 1901.
Over a century. That really shows how long this has been, an issue people have tried to manage.
Definitely.
And the environmental hazards that these regulations are trying to tackle, based on your material, seem to fall into a few big categories, like risks to water.
Yeah, both surface water lakes, streams, even irrigation ditches and groundwater, those underground aquifers we rely on.
And then impacts on living things we don't want to harm, non-target organisms.
Exactly. Pollinators are a huge one, obviously, but also wildlife, endangered species, beneficial insects.
And the sources also mention sensitive areas, places like schools, apiaries, hospitals, habitats.
Right. Anywhere that's particularly vulnerable. And the common thread, like you said, seems to be movement. Pesticides getting away from where they're supposed to be.
If they just stayed put and vanished after doing the job, it'd be simple.
It would solve most of the environmental issues, yeah.
Mm.
But they don't. And why they move and how far really boils down to their inherent characteristics, physical and chemical properties.
Okay. This is where it gets really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
These properties dictate their fate in the environment. The sources call out four key ones. First up, solubility.
Solubility, yeah. Basically how easily it dissolves in liquid, usually water. If a pesticide is highly soluble,
it's more likely to get picked up by water.
Exactly. It can move with surface runoff or leach down through the soil with water. Water's like the main transport system in the environment, so it readily hitches a ride.
Okay, water's the ride. What about adsorption? That sounds like sticking.
It is. Adsorption is how tightly the pesticide molecules bind onto soil particles or organic matter in the soil.
So if it binds tightly, it doesn't wash down as easily.
Correct. It's less likely to leach. But, and this is important, it can still move if the soil itself erodes. Wind or water can carry those soil particles with the pesticide attached offsite.
Ah, okay. So it sticks to the soil and then the soil moves. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Then there's persistence. How long does it, stick around?
Persistence is crucial. It's basically the lifespan of the active pesticide in the environment before it breaks down into something else, hopefully less harmful.
So the longer it lasts.
The longer the window for potential exposure and movement. A persistent pesticide can be a problem across multiple seasons, different weather events. It just hangs around longer.
Got it. And the last one is volatility, turning into a gas.
Right. Volatility is its tendency to vaporize, turn into a gas or vapor. Things like higher temperatures, more wind, low humidity, they all increase volatilization.
And if it turns into a gas?
It can drift away on air currents. This isn't just about tiny spray droplets drifting. The pesticide itself can become a vapor and move, sometimes quite far.
Okay, so you've got these inherent properties controlling behavior. How does that translate into actual physical movement off the target site?
The sources list the main pathways: drift, runoff, leaching.
Exactly those three. Drift is movement through the air. That could be the initial spray droplets, like we just mentioned, or vapors from volatile pesticides, or even pesticide residues stuck to dust particles blowing around.
Okay, air movement. than runoff?
Runoff is water flowing over the surface of the land. It picks up soluble pesticides or maybe soil particles with adsorbed pesticides and carries them into surface water bodies, streams, lakes, ditches.
And leaching is going down?
Down through the soil profile with water, yeah. Percolating downwards. And if it goes deep enough, it can reach groundwater, those aquifers.
And the sources also throw in movement on objects or organisms.
Yes, that's another way. Residues can stick to equipment, like a plow, which then moves soil. Or they might persist on plants or within animals that then move to other areas. Persistence is key there. And it's worth remembering, right, that harm can happen even without movement, if non-target species are just in the treated area.
Absolutely. If beneficial insects or wildlife are present during application or enter the area shortly after, they can be exposed directly, even if the pesticide technically stays within the target zone.
And with those persistent ones, the sources say they can linger for years. So land treated way back could still be an issue.
Yes, definitely. If the land use changes, say from agriculture to housing, those old residues might still be present and pose a risk.
This also relates to how we categorize a pollution source, right? Point source versus non-point source.
Exactly. Point source is contamination from a specific identifiable spot. Think a spill during mixing or improper dumping near a well or runoff from an equipment cleaning area. You can literally point to where it came from.
Whereas non-point source is more spread out.
Much more diffuse, yeah. It's the result of pesticides applied over large areas like agricultural fields. Then rain or irrigation washes small amounts from all over that area into streams or groundwater. It's harder to pin down to one single origin.
Okay, so whether a pesticide actually does move isn't just about its properties. It's this interaction with the environment, the weather, how it's applied. The sources call it an environmental dance.
That's a good way to put it. So many factors come into play.
Let's dig into those factors. For movement in water runoff and leaching, what influences that?
Well, for runoff and the erosion that carries soil-bound pesticides, things like the steepness of the slope are huge.
Mm-hmm.
Also, how much plant cover there is, bare soil erodes much more easily.
Soil type matters too, I assume.
Oh, definitely. Soil texture, structure, and then the water itself. How much water, how fast it's flowing, whether it's intense rainfall or slow irrigation. Temperature plays a role too.
So steep, bare ground, plus a heavy rain is bad news for runoff.
A classic recipe, yeah. Especially if you have a soluble pesticide that just dissolves right into that moving water, or one that's tightly bound to soil that's easily eroded.
And for leaching down into groundwater?
That depends heavily on the pesticide characteristics we talked about. High solubility, low adsorption, high persistence, plus the soil properties. Sandy soils, for instance, or soils low in organic matter, let water pass through much more readily, carrying soluble pesticides with it.
It sounds like clay soils would hold water and pesticides more.
Generally, yes. They have higher adsorption and slower water movement. And the sources make a point here about direct channel contamination. A lot of that comes down to, frankly, carelessness.
Like what?
Handling pesticides near wells or streams, letting equipment wash water drain into the wrong place, not using backflow prevention devices when filling spray tanks from a water source.
So you could accidentally siphon pesticide back into your well.
Exactly. That creates a direct pathway, a point source problem, often just through lack of attention.
Okay. What about factors influencing drift, movement through the air?
We mentioned volatility, but also the physical spray itself matters a lot. Droplet size is key. Smaller droplets drift much farther.
Like a fine mist versus coarser drops.
Precisely. Also, the height the spray is released from, wind speed and direction, obviously. Temperature and humidity affect how quickly droplets evaporate and whether vapors form.
And you mentioned temperature inversions earlier.
Yeah, those are particularly tricky. When you get that stable layer of cool air near the ground, trapped by warmer air above, it prevents vertical air mixing.
So the spray or vapor just hangs there?
It hangs there and can move horizontally for really long distances, often concentrated. It's a major drift hazard condition.
Wow, okay. And movement on objects or organisms, that seems simpler.
It mainly comes back to persistence, yeah. If the residue stays active on a surface, like farm equipment, it can be physically moved.
And that could expose people touching the equipment or contaminate new soil.
Right. Or harm beneficial soil life where that contaminated soil ends up. Or even affect the next crop planted in that soil.
This whole idea of what's left behind the residues seems important.
It is. Residues are just the pesticide remaining on surfaces after application. The amount depends on, you know, the chemical itself, the formulation's persistence, and critically, the application history. How much? How often? Repeat applications can lead to buildup.
Accumulation.
Exactly. And residues, as the sources point out, can be sort of a double-edged sword.
How so?
Well, sometimes you want a residue. Like, for continuous control of external parasites on livestock, you need it to stick around for a while to be effective.
Right.
But often, residues are undesirable. They can lead to unsafe exposure levels for people, pets, wildlife. They can end up in the soil, in water, drift to non-target areas.
Or even show up in animal products like milk. If the animal was treated.
Yes, through absorption or ingestion. And importantly, residues are definitely present in empty pesticide containers. That's why proper cleaning and disposal of those containers is so heavily emphasized. You don't want that concentrated residue leaching out of a dumpster or rinsed into a drain.
Right. Which leads us to, okay, how do we minimize all these hazards? The sources have a pretty practical list.
They do, and it directly ties back to understanding how pesticides move. The absolute first step is the label. Read it, understand it, follow it precisely.
Timing, placement, rate. Use the lowest effective rate.
Exactly. The label instructions are based on research to minimize risk when followed. Beyond that, a lot is about controlling water and soil movement.
Like managing irrigation. Don't use too much water. Time it right.
Right. Limit the potential for runoff, slow down the rate of water seeping down towards groundwater, and adopting practices that reduce soil erosion is key for those pesticides that bind to soil.
Things like conservation tillage, contour farming, keeping vegetation cover?
Precisely. Grass-lined waterways, subsurface drainage, anything that keeps the soil and the pesticide attached to it in place.
What about collecting tailwater?
Yeah, collecting the irrigation water that runs off the end of the field, the tailwater, and reusing it on the same field keeps any dissolved pesticide residue contained within that field system.
And then there's preventing those direct contamination routes, the prite sources.
Absolutely. Be meticulous about avoiding spills, especially near water sources. Clean spills up immediately and properly. Use an air gap or a check valve when filling tanks so you physically can't siphon pesticide back into your well or water supply.
It sounds like careful handling is paramount.
It really is. And also making smart choices before application. Selecting pesticides that break down more quickly, if available and effective. Using formulations designed to reduce drift, like larger droplet sizes. And calibrating your equipment accurately.
So you know you're putting on exactly the right amount, only where it's needed.
Correct. It's all about minimizing the amount available to move off-site and blocking the pathways for movement.
Okay, so we've covered movement and minimizing it. Let's pivot to the impacts when things do go wrong or when exposure happens, starting with water supplies. Groundwater seems like a huge concern.
It's critical. The sources state about 2/3 of the water we rely on is groundwater. And in places like California, where you have a lot of agriculture and development over aquifers, it's especially vulnerable.
And the scary part is, once it's contaminated.
It's incredibly difficult, sometimes practically impossible, to clean up. The sources mention it can take hundreds of years for natural processes to remove contaminants. It's a very long-term problem.
A legacy issue. That really hammers home the need for prevention.
Absolutely. Surface water contamination is also serious, often impacting drinking water sources more directly, though treatment is sometimes possible. This usually happens via runoff or erosion carrying pesticides into rivers and lakes.
Then there are the sensitive areas. What defines those?
Basically, anywhere that living things could be easily harmed, or where vulnerable populations gather. So schools, hospitals, neighborhoods are obvious ones.
But also natural areas.
Yes, habitats for endangered species, wildlife refuges, parks, bee yards, apiaries, even pastures where domestic animals graze, or fields with crops not listed on the pesticide label.
And the precautions mentioned are things like just not spraying there.
Or leaving buffers.
Exactly. Avoidance, creating untreated buffer zones around the sensitive area, carefully selecting less harmful pesticides if treatment is essential, and importantly, locating mixing, loading, and cleanup sites well away from these zones.
And California has specific, extra strict rules near schools and daycares.
Very specific. Things like mandatory notification before certain applications near schools, and prohibitions on applying most pesticides during school hours, Monday to Friday, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., basically.
Okay.
Plus minimum distance requirements, like a quarter mile for some application types, or 25 feet for others, depending on the equipment and the pesticide. It's about creating multiple layers of protection for kids.
Makes sense. Okay, let's talk impacts on non-target organisms, stuff we don't mean to hit.
Right. Pesticides are designed to be toxic to something, so it's not a huge surprise they can harm other organisms too. Some are broad spectrum, hitting a wide range.
While others are more selective.
Yes, but even selective pesticides can cause indirect harm. If you kill off the main food source for a beneficial insect, for example, that beneficial might starve or leave, disrupting the natural balance.
And that disruption can lead to this thing called pest resurgence.
Yes, this is a really important concept the sources bring up. Imagine you spray a pesticide. It kills the target pest, but it also kills the natural enemies, the predators and parasites that normally help keep that pest in check.
Okay.
If the pesticide doesn't get 100% of the pest, the surviving pests suddenly have no natural enemies left. Their population can explode, sometimes even exceeding the level it was at before you sprayed.
So spraying actually made the pest problem worse in the long run. Wow.
It can happen. It highlights the complexity of just intervening in an ecosystem.
Endangered species are another big focus.
Huge concern. These species are already struggling. Agencies identify their critical habitats, and specific pesticide uses might be restricted or prohibited in those areas to avoid pushing them further towards extinction. The sources mentioned checking with various agencies or databases like DPRs prescribe for restrictions.
And bees, pollinators in general.
Mm-hmm.
Vital but vulnerable.
Extremely vulnerable to many insecticides and even some fungicides. Direct exposure while they're foraging is a major risk.
And they can carry it back to the hive.
Yes, contaminated pollen or nectar can be brought back, potentially harming the queen, the brood, the whole colony. Given how essential pollinators are, there are often rules about notifying nearby beekeepers before applying harmful pesticides when plants are blooming. Labels also carry specific warnings.
What about less direct, maybe longer-term impacts? The sources mentioned bioaccumulation.
Right. This is mainly an issue with persistent pesticides, the ones that don't break down quickly. Organisms absorb the pesticide, often from their food, faster than they can get rid of it.
So it builds up in their bodies.
Exactly. And then when a predator eats lots of prey that have low levels of this pesticide, the pesticide concentrates in the predator. It magnifies up the food chain.
To potentially toxic levels.
Yes. Eventually reaching levels that can harm the predator's health, reduce its ability to reproduce, or even cause death. Think DDT in eagles, that's the classic example.
And secondary kills are related.
Kind of a more acute version. That's when, say, a hawk eats a rodent that recently consumed poison bait. The hawk gets a large lethal dose all at once from that single meal.
Livestock can be affected too.
Definitely. Accidental ingestion, maybe grooming pesticide off their coat if it was applied improperly, or drift onto pasture. The symptoms can range from mild irritation to severe neurological problems or death.
And the advice is, call a vet immediately. Have the label ready.
Absolutely critical for treatment.
And even plants we don't want to kill can be harmed, right?
Yeah.
Especially by herbicides drifting.
Yes. Non-target plants, desirable landscape plants, neighboring crops, or native vegetation can all be damaged or killed by herbicide drift or runoff.
And losing native flora isn't just about looks, is it?
Not at all. Native plants are vital for watershed health, erosion control, providing habitat and food for wildlife. If herbicides wipe them out, often less desirable, weedy species take over, changing the whole ecosystem function.
And you mentioned this earlier, but it ties in here. Secondary pest outbreaks.
Right. Killing off the primary pest, or its natural enemies, can sometimes allow a different organism, one that was previously kept in check naturally, to increase and become a pest itself. You solve one problem and potentially create another.
It really underscores how interconnected everything is.
It really does.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, the big takeaway from this material seems to be the sheer complexity. Pesticide use isn't simple. It's this interaction between the chemical, the environment, the application, human choices.
And understanding all those interactions, those pathways of movement like drift, runoff, leaching, and the factors influencing them is absolutely fundamental if we want to use these tools while minimizing harm to water, wildlife, and sensitive areas.
This material definitely helps connect those dots, showing how one aspect impacts another, which leaves us with a final thought to chew on, maybe. Given all these intricate ways pesticides can move and cause effects, what might the future hold? How could innovations in, say, monitoring or maybe super precise application tech or even completely different pest management strategies help us get even better at protecting these vulnerable parts of our world?
That's the ongoing challenge, isn't it? Finding smarter, more targeted ways to manage pests that work more harmoniously with the environmental systems rather than potentially disrupting them. It's a fascinating area for future development.
Indeed. We hope this deep dive has given you some valuable insights and maybe sparked some further curiosity about these complex systems that shape our world.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.